Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. The United States joined Russia, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait to sideline climate science at this year's climate talks in Katowice, Poland. The four countries out of nearly 200 refused to endorse the landmark UN report that says we have just 12 years for global warming to be kept at 1.5 degrees Celsius. Activists and citizens from around the globe yelled "keep it in the ground" during a Trump administration event to promote fossil fuels. They also took to the heavily militarized streets where they were met by armed police in riot gear. This morning, activists demanded bolder action with signs that said "system change, not climate change," and "which side are you on?" Activists were told that if they specifically named oil and gas companies while demonstrating, they would have their accreditation taken away by the UN. Today's guest, Shannon Osaka, just returned from the conference in Katowice, Poland. Shannon is an environmental journalist. She covered the climate summit for GRIST, an independent environmental online news organization. Hi, Shannon. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you. Thank you. We are also joined by Antonia Juhas, an investigative journalist covering the oil industry. Antonia has written extensively about the influence of big oil. She's the author of three books, including Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. In a recent LA Times op-ed, Antonia Juhas writes that the Trump administration has unleashed a massive, untethered expansion of oil, natural gas, and coal production, designed to make this country the world's foremost dirty energy powerhouse. Hi, Antonia. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. Well, as we do on the Media Roundtable every week, we start off on a positive note by highlighting journalism that stood out. So, Shannon, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that caught your attention?
Yeah, so my friend and colleague Daniel Jutt wrote a piece in The Nation that he called "A Conference on Climate Change Became a Conference on Coal," really digging into the issues around this particular city of Katowice in Poland, which is so coal-dependent and really the center of the coal industry in Poland. And he talked about basically the history of coal in Poland and what needs to change if we're going to hit that 1.5 degree Celsius mark.
The convention center is modeled after a coal mine, is that right?
Yeah, that is kind of the rumor. And if you go inside, when you look around the inside of the convention center, it's lined with these huge pieces of black metal that really look like mining shafts.
And we'll talk about this later in the show, but since you brought up this piece by your colleague, Daniel Jutt, what else did he uncover? I mean, what role did coal play at this conference?
So coal played a pretty big role. What you saw was President Duda of Poland saying that he would not really consider taking coal out of Poland's energy mix. He in fact said, you know, here in Poland we have 200 years of coal reserves. And when you put that with the recent IPCC report, which says that we basically need to cut coal by 97% in the next 12 years, that just doesn't make sense. So we were seeing these two very different, one scientific narrative and then one, this kind of Polish narrative, really clash at COP24.
Well, we will link to this article by Daniel Jutt, "A Conference on Climate Change Became a Conference on Coal," for The Nation. Thank you for that. That is Shannon Osaka. She covered the climate summit for GRIST. What about you, Antonia? What did you see this week that caught your attention?
Yeah, there was just so much in the news. It was really hard to choose my kudos this week. So I picked two. And the first was an article from the LA Times by Evan Halper that really dug into this new Clean Water Act rule that the Trump administration is slashing, showing that the administration is poised to strip protections from up to two-thirds of California's streams and millions of acres nationwide, which is an enormous amount of deregulation. And it's a rollback of protections that had been established under the Obama administration, and a really important dig into the particular effects in California. And then the second was a piece in Outside Magazine on a similar theme by Mark Peruzzi, and it's looking at using the attempts by the Trump administration to drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge or to open up the wildlife refuge, and the tools that are being used to accelerate drilling in the refuge are attacks on NEPA, the National Environmental Protection Act, that could be applied all across the country and are basically part of this broader strategy, which I talked about in my Los Angeles Times op-ed, of a massive deregulation opening up as much of the country, but particularly focused on federal lands right now, to oil and gas drilling. And this article provided a deeper dive into the tools that the administration is using to do that than I could provide in my 900-word op-ed. And I thought it was a really great piece of reporting in Outside Magazine.
Well, thank you for that. And we will link to those very important pieces at Your Call Radio right after the show. That is Antonia Yuhas, an investigative journalist covering the oil industry. Antonia, you covered the COP21 Paris climate negotiations. Can you, before we dive in and talk about what happened in Poland, can you talk about the significance of these climate conferences? I mean, what happens there? What's the goal of these conferences?
I mean, I think the first thing to say is COP24 isn't over. So we're in the final, like, critical hours of what's going to happen at COP24, and that's the current negotiations happening in Poland right now. And, as you had mentioned in the opening, there's been a tremendous outpouring of action just in the last couple hours. Hundreds of climate activists swarmed the negotiating hall demanding meaningful action in these talks. And these talks are really putting in place the rule book to implement what was agreed to in Paris in 2015. And the Paris Climate Accord was an entirely new moment in international climate negotiations, with basically 196 nations of the world agreeing that the world is in a climate crisis and immediate action needs to be taken to reduce carbon emissions, and laying out a path to commitments from each country to how it would reduce its own carbon footprint. But one of the more important parts of the accord was a $500 billion financial commitment from the world's governments to help developing countries transition away from fossil fuels and deal with the immediate impacts of devastating climate change. And meeting those financial commitments is honestly, to me, one of the most important, the necessity of meeting those financial commitments is one of the most important outcomes of Paris, and one of the biggest failures of seeing, one of the many failures of seeing the Trump administration take the place of the Obama administration. Now, there were many, many places where Paris not only didn't succeed to meet the demands of climate activists, but also created what many see as further problems by locking in carbon trading schemes and areas of the agreement that are actually could make the situation worse and not better. Sorry, I have a fire engine coming down the street, which I'm hope isn't making too much noise over the over the air.
No, that's okay.
Okay, but I would say, you know, overall, Paris created most significantly what I wrote as a way station to the changes that, you know, laying the groundwork for what then needs to happen. You had this incredible coming together of a climate movement that showed itself powerfully all around the world at the time of the Paris Climate Accords. It has continued to grow. You saw governments make this commitment to action that they hadn't made before, a commitment to financial contributions that they hadn't made before, and then right now the negotiations in Poland are supposed to actually, you know, lock in how those transformations are supposed to take place, how the commitments that each government made to how it was going to shift from a carbon-based economy, carbon-based energy sources, was going to take place.
And Shannon, you covered this year's summit in Katowice, Poland. As Antonia said, it is just wrapping up, so we're not sure how it's going to end. But what would you add about the significance of these talks, just based on the people you interviewed there, the people on the streets, as well as the people who actually make the decisions?
Hugely significant, largely because of what we've just heard from the IPCC, that we really have about 12 years to fundamentally transform the energy system. And when you're talking about the Paris Agreement rulebook, there's a lot of jargon, there's a lot of arguments over one verb or another. I mean, the disagreement where the U.S., Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Russia basically stopped something being in the preamble of the rulebook was over a discussion between the words welcome and the words note. So that's the kind of thing that they're talking about. What I was most impressed by from being at the conference was seeing all of the activism that was happening kind of behind the scenes. The conference is both a conference for these negotiators, these international delegations, but it's also a conference for civil society and activists, particularly young activists, who are coming together and trying to figure out how can they pressure their governments from the bottom up. So what you see from the negotiations is very much a top-down angle, but at the same time, there's all these people agitating and really trying to make these changes at the subnational level as well.
Can you talk more about that? Because I'd like to give a shout out to Democracy Now. Their team goes to these conferences every year, and they're out on the streets. They interview people who've been directly affected by climate change. And you've got people from Kerala, India, from Uganda, the Philippines, Costa Rica, the Maldives, people from all over the world talking about how they are directly affected by climate change. So can you talk more about that, Shannon? It's such an important angle. And do you find that, you know, national media outlets, are they interviewing these activists who've traveled so far to raise their voices and talk about what they're facing?
You know, I think it really varies. I think a lot of national news outlets do focus very much on the nitty-gritty of the negotiations. And I think that's kind of a shame, because when you're at the talk, you can really see that it's all these multiple different conferences happening at once. And the most inspiring people are the people that you meet who are young activists. And they are really kind of trying to pull the negotiations forward by the strength of will and energy and numbers. I did a brief story about this Swedish teenager. Her name's Greta Thunberg. And she was there at the conference and was just making these very real, blunt statements, even to the Secretary General of the UN, saying, we as young people think that you're not doing enough and that we need less talk and more action. And that was really inspiring to see. And I think another thing that was amazing was there was a climate march last weekend when I was still there, and you saw a lot of Polish environmentalists marching, again, in sort of the coal capital of Poland, marching to prevent air pollution, marching to change Poland's electricity from being 80% coal. So it is really this global movement, and I think more attention needs to be placed on those activists who I think are really doing the work to pull the negotiators along, to push the negotiators to do their jobs.
Exactly, and they were protesting on very heavily militarized streets. They were met by armed police in riot gear, and activists were told that they could not specifically name oil and gas companies while they demonstrated, or they'd have their accreditation taken away.
It was really kind of insane. I was there. There were so many riot police. They had tear gas. They had water cannons that they were driving through the streets. It was lucky in the fact that there was a small scuffle with the police and three people were detained and then later released, to my knowledge. But the environment in Poland has not been a particularly open one for protest. There's the government passed a no spontaneous protest rule for the period that the conference is taking place. All the protests and actions that take place inside the conference center are heavily controlled as well. I heard some young people say that they even were being told that they couldn't take pictures in matching shirts. So there was kind of a crackdown feeling at the conference, but at the same time, people were really not dissuaded. There were a lot of both Polish activists and activists from all over the world, including from the United States, who were still there making their voices heard.
Yes, activists from the United States, but the U.S. delegation with the Trump administration promoted coal at the talks, and that session, a number of activists were yelling at that session, even laughing, while these people were touting fossil fuels.
Yeah, I thought that was actually a particularly successful protest tactic, the laughter, because it is ridiculous. I mean, we are having, the U.S. is still in the Paris Agreement technically until 2020. They're undertaking the process of exiting the agreement. And what's funny is that the timeline for exiting the agreement will have the U.S. exit the day after the 2020 presidential election. That's kind of a funny thing to note. Wells Griffith, President Trump's energy advisor, was chairing this panel that was really pushing fossil fuels, was pushing coal. I was really proud that there were a number of young activists and indigenous activists from the U.S. who were just standing up and saying, this is ridiculous. I mean, we as a country, the U.S. has 5% of the world's population, and we're responsible for about 28% of the carbon emissions currently in the atmosphere. And so we, above anyone else, really need to take a stand. And to have the administration send these figures who are really representing big oil, the big oil industry, or even representing coal, is really ridiculous.
Antonia, you have covered oil for a long time and climate change. What is the significance of the United States when it has these sessions saying that fossil fuels are the future, or when the person that's sent there is Wells Griffith? He is the special assistant to Trump for international energy and the environment, doesn't have any experience on this issue at all. When he ran for Congress, he talked about, the Bible. He lost his seat. But again, another climate denier. And then the U.S. joining with Russia, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait to sideline climate science. How significant is this?
It's incredibly significant. I mean, I think a word choice goes a long way in an international legal document, which is what the COP24 conclusion will be. Will be a new legal document on how 196 nations in the world are or not going to meet commitments that they made to reduce emissions and shift from a carbon-based economy. Now, I think where the direction that many of the activists that we're talking about wanted to see these negotiations go is to specifically talk about keeping fossil fuels in the ground, the necessity that the IPCC has found in the past of at least 80% or more of existing fossil fuels would need to stay in the ground to ensure that we didn't suffer the most extreme consequences of climate change, and to see that shift happen. Instead, what's happened is, of course, the Trump administration has gone the entirely opposite direction. And as I write in my LA Times piece, the Trump administration joined what is now a new oil bloc. So Saudi Arabia has always been dominant in global climate negotiations in trying to obstruct negotiations to take meaningful action on the climate. Russia has always been a part of that, but it's been somewhat more of a silent player. The Trump administration now, with actions that it's taken that I detail in the piece over the last year, has dramatically increased domestic oil and natural gas and coal production. And with the increase in oil production in particular, the United States, Russia, and Saudi Arabia now produce more oil, the three of them together, for the first time than all 15 members of OPEC combined. They are the new power when it comes to oil. And the three, I would say, are also the world leaders in really wanting to ensure that the world remains committed to fossil fuels broadly, but oil in particular. And they really made their public debut as a bloc in Poland by blocking the inclusion of that critical UN IPCC report, and that was a report that was that the United Nations asked the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, to perform, to say basically what would happen if we don't keep the average global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius above the industrial levels. And the IPCC delivered that report in June, and that report said basically we will pass a precipice of no return if within 12 years we don't succeed in holding average climate increases to 1.5 degrees Celsius. And that, and what the report detailed is just much worse of everything that people are experiencing right now. And we in California don't really need to be told much more what those impacts are after our year, our increasing years of fire and the devastation that has been brought by these fires and the necessity of action. So instead, what the Trump administration went to Poland to do, and they released the State Department released a statement which said, we think fossil fuels need to be a part of the solution, all fossil fuels. We think that the United States needs to leave Paris, the Paris Climate Accord, unless the Paris Climate Accord meets America's needs, essentially puts America first, and is saying, you know, very straightforwardly, we need to pursue fossil fuels. That's America's vision. And if the world isn't going to get on board with that, then we're not going to be a part of helping. And what activists are saying on the ground in Poland is that what's happened is the United States has basically become one of these major obstructors to any sort of meaningful action, and that the end result of these negotiations could therefore be a significant fall backwards on the places where action is needed. So again, like I said, there's definitely disagreement on parts of the Paris Climate Accord that have pieces like cap and trade that many, particularly indigenous communities from around the world and in the United States, see as more harmful than helpful. But I think there is full agreement on many of the key components of the necessity of global action on climate change, of the need to move to keeping fossil fuels in the ground, to decarbonize the economy, to put equity and the necessity of a transfer of wealth that helps countries that are suffering the worst impacts of climate change but have done the least to contribute to it, to not only deal with the current impacts but to adapt, et cetera, et cetera. And these are all things that were at least the basis has been in these negotiations. And now we've got the Trump administration joining Saudi Arabia and Russia to block meaningful progress.
We have about 30 seconds before break, Antonia. As you said in your LA Times piece, you say that this is a new oil block. What do you expect in the near future from these three countries on this issue?
The worst version is supporting each other in their worst activities, and not just on fossil fuels, right? So then we're also talking about Yemen. We're also talking about the Ukraine. We're also talking about the places where essentially Khashoggi. We're talking about the extent to which these three countries are going to support each other in their activities, with, for me, the bottom line being of their alliance, that the one thing they share most fundamentally is a commitment to supporting this industry, which certainly for Saudi Arabia and Russia is the heart of their entire economy, is oil. It's the lifeline for these political leaders in their countries. And they will, you know, they want this to be an alliance. And so to me, the sort of worst vision is not just the support of fossil fuels, but these three countries deciding to support each other, or these three leaders deciding, excuse me, to support each other in their worst activities.
Antonia Juhas is an independent investigative journalist covering the oil industry. Her latest book is called Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Shannon Osaka just returned from the climate conference in Katowice, Poland. She covered it for GRIST, an independent environmental online news organization. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this. Thank you.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion, or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to yourcall@klw.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, it's a further delve into the week's news with 1A from WAMU in Washington. Stay with us.
This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about coverage of the climate talks in Katowice, Poland, and climate change with Antonia Juhas, an investigative journalist covering the oil industry. She has written extensively about the influence of big oil. Her most recent book is Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. We're also joined by Shannon Osaka. She just returned from the conference in Katowice, Poland. She covered the summit for GRIST, an independent environmental online news organization. Shannon, can you talk more about what you're hearing from activists about the role that the United States is playing? I mean, it's really not new to get in the way of, you know, the talks. I mean, this has happened in the past where various people would go and get in the way of talks. People would talk about, you know, embracing fossil fuels. This is nothing new, but Trump has really taken this to a new level. So what do you hear from people about the role of the U.S.?
Yeah, I think it definitely is a new level. I mean, this is the second time that the Trump administration has hosted a pro-coal event at one of these conferences. And what I've heard from a lot of activists is just continued frustration. And I think, again, what was so successful about the protest that we just saw against the Team Trump coal event was just that it put it in its place, kind of as this is a ridiculous event. No one knows why it's happening here. It's only for the Trump administration to tout their own beliefs and hopefully few other countries besides that bloc that Antonia was just talking about will be paying very much attention. But that said, I think you can see a lot of other action happening at the United States. For example, the We Are Still In group, which is a group of businesses, states, and other organizations that are coming together to say that they're going to try to uphold the Paris Agreement, even if the federal government will not. And that's a really hopeful development that has happened since Trump left the Paris Agreement or said that he's officially going to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement. But really, what I'm hearing from a lot of activists is frustration that their demands and calls for climate justice, their calls for the U.S. to move in a more renewable direction, and at the very least for the U.S. not to be impeding and obstructing the process of these international negotiations, are really going unheeded.
And Antonia, what would you add to that? I mean, you have the movement for the Green New Deal here in the United States. There were major actions in D.C. and in San Francisco in front of Nancy Pelosi's office. You also have 300 mayors, state representatives, and elected officials from 40 states releasing a letter today calling for a nationwide plan to phase out the production and the use of fossil fuels and to ramp up renewable energy as part of a Green New Deal.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the Green New Deal organizing is extremely exciting and represents this new progressive voices in the Democratic Party in the House, and of course that the Democrats will be the majority come the fall. And the goal of the right now of the Green New Deal is to create a new select committee on a Green New Deal in the House that will focus essentially exclusively on really turning the idea into legislation? What does it mean to not just transition 100% away from fossil fuels in the United States, but to do so in a way that builds a strong, vibrant, green, just economy, and that, you know, to model it after the New Deal? And I think it's very, very exciting. And I covered in San Francisco a protest that happened here. So in D.C. this week, 1,000 young people protested in the halls of Congress demanding that Democrats sign on to the Green New Deal. And then in San Francisco, they focus on Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi, who's going to be the speaker, on her office and on just bringing more attention to the calls for the Green New Deal. I mean, I think the Trump administration is definitely a fundamental shift on many levels from the Obama administration when we're talking in particular about fossil fuels. And I think what we're seeing is essentially that the peeling away of any concept of regulation or limits on the industry. So while the Obama administration certainly, you know, didn't say, well, the Obama administration did say that it did in fact implement a rule, no new coal leasing on federal lands, which the Trump administration removed. It didn't say that for oil and gas, right? It didn't say we're gonna implement across the board, we're not gonna pursue oil and gas development. What it did was really tighten the regulatory screws more on oil and gas. And the Trump administration has removed those regulatory screws. And it's really very much much more akin to the Reagan administration in that sense on domestic oil and gas production, and really just unleashing the ability of the industry to do, you know, kids in a candy store is how I would describe it. The oil and gas industry is asking for whatever it can from the administration, and it's getting it and more. And so that has really unleashed and we're seeing it moving even the administration moving even more aggressively now to even do more deregulatory action moving into the coming year. This, you know, sort of torrent of production, and at the international level, again, you're seeing the administration aggressively trying to move away from internationalism, from making commitments on anything that it doesn't see as, quote, putting America first. And whereas the Obama administration, for all of its failures on the international level, certainly saw itself as part of an international or internationalism as part of its mandate, and that was certainly evidenced in at the way that it behaved at the global climate negotiations versus the way the Trump administration is behaving and seeing its role.
Antonia, we're almost out of time, but you did a great job of listing so many of the rollbacks that we have seen. I mean, it's very hard to keep up with all of this. As you point out, the Trump administration has unleashed a massive untethered expansion of oil, natural gas, and coal production. 4 days after the inauguration, they fast-tracked the Dakota Access Oil Pipeline. Rule changes across federal agencies resulted in frozen regulatory processes. The EPA has eliminated rules that regulate coal ash. It's such a long list. Now that these rules have been rolled back, have companies jumped in to do what they couldn't do last year? That's the one thing that I'd love to know more about.
I mean, basically what we've seen is a mass opening of public land. So compared to just 2 years ago, there is six times the amount of public land now open to oil and gas drilling than there was just 2 years ago. Six wow. times the amount. So American public land that is now open to oil and gas drilling. And just in the past year, the amount of oil and natural gas wells that the Department of Interior is overseeing, so the number of oil and natural gas wells under the Interior Department's purview, which means on federal land, has increased 85%. So they are opening up everything they can to drilling, and the drilling is happening. Now, this was already a trend that was expanding. So, for example, the Trump administration, of course, fast-tracked completion of the Dakota Access Pipeline. Simply by allowing the pipeline to be completed, that sent North Dakota's oil production to the highest amount that it had ever reached previously. And now they're producing so much that they say that they need another pipeline. The U.S. was already increasing its oil and gas production under Obama. This began under Bush. It continued under Obama. But it has catapulted under Trump. And what the Trump administration is envisioning, and so we're producing more oil and natural gas than we have ever produced in our entire history. We are exporting more fossil fuels than we've ever exported in our history. We are importing more, not more than we've ever imported in our history, but we're on an upward trajectory on imports. Basically, what the Trump administration is envisioning is sort of the United States is this giant sort of oil and gas production washing machine. More comes in, more goes out. It gets refined into other stuff. It gets refined into plastics. It gets refined into gasoline. It gets produced here and just making us this big sort of churning oil and natural gas machine and fossil fuel machine. The United States had been on a downward trend for 6 years on coal production, and that was reversed under the Trump administration. So yes, the companies are taking advantage of it, and there's more down the pike. And these are all, I mean, I think the importance of pointing it out is that there are rules that can be reversed. You can put back in place regulation. You can say, this isn't the trajectory we want to see. But right now, I would say if the Trump administration had two areas where it was most successful, it would be its immigration policies and its fossil fuel policies. And those are places that I, hope people will pay even more attention to. And as you said, to end on a positive note, of course people are, and they're taking action. The Green New Deal would radically reverse this Trump administration agenda and really lock into place the necessity of shifting from fossil fuels and rejecting fossil fuels to a green economy.
Antonia Yuhas is an investigative journalist covering the oil industry. Her most recent book is Black Tide, The Devastating Impact of the Gulf Oil Spill. Antonia, thanks for your work. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Rose.
Thank you. Shannon Osaka just returned from the conference in Katowice, Poland. She covered it for GRIST, an independent environmental news organization. Shannon, thank you for your work, and we'd love to have you back.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. It is our media roundtable. And now we are going to talk about why the massive protests in France over gas tax hikes snowballed into a wider revolt over the high cost of living, inequality, and French President Emmanuel Macron's neoliberal policies. We are joined by Tomas Cantalubi, a reporter at Mediapart's online newspaper and a former U.S. correspondent based in Paris. Hi, is it Tomas or Thomas?
Whatever, Thomas is good.
Okay, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Can we start off talking about some very basic questions here? Because, the media were focusing first on the gas tax, and then the protests really exploded into a wider revolt about, economic issues. People are really struggling. I thought the New York Times had a pretty good piece called These Five Numbers Explain Why the French Are in the Streets. Mm-hmm. And they report that the median take-home pay for people in France is about $1,900, meaning that half of French workers are actually paid less than that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a correct figure. Of course, it's hard to compare with the U.S. because that includes a wide safety net that includes medical care, that includes unemployment benefits, etc. So you cannot really compare $1,900 in France and $1,900 in the U.S. But still, it's not much, and that's why people are protesting.
And what about inequality in France? The top 20% of the population earns five times as much as the bottom 20%?
Exactly, and it's been growing like all over the world, mostly in the modern economies. That's what's happened. Inequalities are growing, and inequality, as in the U.S., has become a big topic in France. And what's interesting is that this yellow vest revolt or protest started over something like the diesel tax. But actually, you have to go a little bit in the past to see why it ballooned in such a way. Because actually, people were encouraged for many years to buy diesel cars in France. because the taxes were lower on diesel fuel, and two of the big car manufacturers in France were selling lots of diesel cars. So basically for almost 20, 30 years, people were told to buy diesel cars, and suddenly they're told, wow, diesel is very polluting, and you better stop, and we're going to tax it. So people are angry about that, because it's a sudden shift in their way of life and in their own personal economy. And that ballooned with the way that French has been governed for the past, I would say, 20 years or so, with very identical policies, whether it was Sarkozy who was on the right, or Hollande who was supposedly on the left, or Macron who is supposedly in the center. Mostly it's the same, as you said before, neoliberal policies. And it's actually a revolt against those neoliberal policies that are promoted by the French elites. And that's why I wanted to go a little bit in backward to see what happened about this diesel, because diesel was promoted by the French government, by the French elite, by the French businessmen. And then suddenly those same elites say, well, you've got to stop driving a diesel car. You've got to convert and buy an electric car, or a car that runs on unleaded fuel. And it's very expensive for people, and they cannot do that. And of course, at the same time, people who use a lot of their cars are people who live in the countryside or in big metropolis. And at the same time, the public services, the trains, the buses, have been defunded. There are less trains in France today than there were a century ago. There are less regional or metropolitan buses as there were 50 years ago. So people don't have much choice. They have to use their car, and their car is becoming more and more expensive.
And a little bit more information about Emmanuel Macron. He is a former investment banker. He's been called a president of the rich. And in his first year in office, he cut taxes for France's wealthiest taxpayers.
Exactly. He suppressed something that had been in France since 1981, when the socialist and François Mitterrand came in power, which was called impôt sur la fortune, which is mostly a wealth tax. On people, I would say, I don't know the correct figures, but people who have who earn more than $1 million a year, or have a property that's over $1.5 million a year, $1.5 million, and it was mostly symbolical. I mean, lots of people could get around this tax by giving away money to NGOs, to caritative institutions, but it was a symbol. It was a symbol that if you earned a lot of money, you were going to pay a lot of taxes, or at least a little bit more taxes. And Macron, one of his first gesture when he came in power, was to suppress these taxes. So what does that say? I mean, the first decision you make is important as a president. And his first decision was to suppress this tax. And it actually cost around between 4 to 5 billion a year to the French budget. And of course it's a symbol, so people are angry about that. And when you see the result of this suppression of tax, actually you see that the 1%, the richer 1% in France, have got to pay less taxes now than they used to before, while the middle class pretty much pay the same, and mostly, I mean, people who are on a lower income in France don't really pay taxes at all, except for the sales tax. So So this was a symbol that was quite strong, and it was not lost on the people, and that's why Emmanuel Macron, who came into power under a conjunction of circumstances that were quite unique, because he was a newcomer and he faced the extreme right at the second round of the election. But he was, if you see the figures on the first round of election, Emmanuel Macron only garnered 20% of the electorate. So basically you can say that only really 20% were behind him. And when he came into power, he promised to be a centrist, I mean, taking from the left, taking from the right. And what we've seen so far, especially in economic policy, is mostly neoliberal rightist policies.
We're speaking with Tomas Cantalupi. He's a reporter at Mediapart online newspaper, former U.S. correspondent based in Paris. And we're talking about the uprising took off on November 17th in France. Since you're talking about politics, can you talk about, what is the status of leftists, leftist politicians specifically, in France?
Well, for now, mostly it's gathered around a figure named Jean-Luc Mélenchon, which is the head of the France Insoumise, which you could translate it as unsubmitted French. And they're actually, the biggest, or at least the most vocal opposition in parliament. But it's also because left of center, what used to be the Parti Socialiste, is a remnant of itself, and Les Républicains, which is right-wing conservative akin to the Republicans in the U.S. is not very brilliant right now. So Emmanuel Macron and his party called La République En Marche are very dominant. They got something like almost 400 seats at the National Assembly out of 580 deputies, so representatives. So it's quite a lot. They're a dominant force. And the left is the most vocal. But what's interesting with the Yellow Vest movement is it didn't start within the left. It didn't start with unions. It didn't start with La France Insoumise. It started very much as a grassroots movement. And part of the left joined later, as did also part of the right. So it makes for a very strange, very intriguing, very complex movement, because those Yellow Vests are mostly grassroots people. Many of them are not politicized. They aren't used to political protests. They don't belong to any parties. And they, of course, have been joined by people from the left and people from the right, and people from the extreme right and people from the extreme left. So it's a very interesting and very complex movement.
Can you talk about how things have changed over the month, and what about the demands? How have those changed?
Well, as we said before, I mean, the demand started as to rescind the hike on the fuel tax, and that has been done. It took a while for the government to react, but they suppressed the tax. But of course, the demands had snowballed after that, and now the demands are, I would say, they're a bit all over the place, because some people asked for the end to migration, others has asked for a hike to the minimum wage. Others asked for Macron to leave the presidency. Others asked for new elections. So others asked for more public transport. Others asked for a green transition. So it's all over the place. But I think if you had to summarize it, it's mostly a revolt, a rebellion against neoliberal policies that have been dominant, whether it's in France, in Germany, in the UK, in the US, for the past 20 to 30 years. It's a revolt against this consensus that you've got to lower taxes, suppress public services, and hope for what the Chicago economist invented, which is a trickle-down economy, which never happened, which has never been proven by any economic statistics. But that's what's ongoing in France, as is in most of Europe. And that's what we've seen in all of those countries. It's the gap in inequality is rising. The rich are getting richer. The poor might not get a lot poorer, but their wages aren't going up. And they still have mostly the same wages, the same, we call it in France, pouvoir d'achat, which is what you can buy with your money. It's not going up, it's not going down. And they see the very rich getting richer and richer and paying less and less taxes, and public services being degraded, and the government and always telling them that they have a solution. But of course, you also know that in France there's a high unemployment. It's been around 10% for the past 20 or 25 years. And every government that has arrived in France said, I have a solution. That's what we're going to do, and we promised unemployment is going to go down. And it never goes down. So it's also a question of trust in the government.
In our remaining minute, Tomas, where do you see the protests going? I mean, as you said, the demands vary depending on who you talk to. One protester said that Macron wants to give the French people some crumbs, but they want the whole baguette. Do you think that this protest, this uprising, will bring about substantive changes?
Well, one can only hope so. What's difficult is that there's been a terrorist attack in the eastern part of France, in Strasbourg, 2 days ago. So now there's a call for the end of the protest, because it's the tensions are against rising around terrorism. So, and of course, you've got the Christmas holidays who are coming in France, so it will be difficult to carry on the protest. But what's for sure is that this movement has sort of it's a first step. I think people are not going to stop their demands for a more just and a more equal society, and I think that's the big impact that the Yale West had, and maybe it's going to carry on in 2019. I don't see big protests going on for the next weeks, but it's something that will remain. Also, because it was a movement of people gathering together around roads, in towns, on the town squares, and it's people who weren't used to talk together. They weren't part of unions. They weren't part of political parties. And suddenly, they gathered. They started exchanging ideas and reivindications and demands. And they found a common ground. It's a powerful force for people who used not to be heard and not to discuss politics.
Mm. Yes, very powerful. We will definitely do an entire show in 2019. Tomas, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tomas Cantalupi is a reporter at Mediapart, a leftist online newspaper in Paris, and a former U.S. correspondent. You can find his work at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.